Okay, I'm going to introduce the person who's going to introduce the speaker.
Now I'm going to introduce the guy that introduced them. Hi, I'm Evan. So it is my privilege tonight to introduce our speaker, who I am blessed to say is a friend of mine that I met through this program. He and I are brothers in this program, meaning to say we have the same sponsor. And when I have a problem that I don't want my sponsor to hear about, then I call this guy. When you hear how sick he is, you'll get some idea of how sick I am that he's taking my calls. So without any further ado, I'd like to introduce Matt M.
Hi, everyone. My name is Matthew Mize, and I'm grateful to be an Al-Anon member. I want to thank Evan for asking me to speak here tonight, and I want to thank you guys for allowing me to speak here. This goes to the newcomers. Newcomers, I hope that I say something tonight that'll resonate in your head and make you want to keep coming back, because my first Al-Anon meeting, almost 6 years ago, there was someone who said something that made me want to keep coming back, and my life has changed because of it. So I hope that what I share tonight will hit you in that spot. And if everyone else, I hope you guys like what I have to say. I already been told by a few people, if they don't like what I say, they're going to get up and just walk out. No, just kidding. He was actually apologizing to me because he has to leave early. So, I was supposed to shout out to Dublin and Mike. Just kidding. You know, that's one of the things about this program is the laughter. I love the laughter about this program, because when I came into this program, I had nothing to laugh about. My life was over. I was devastated. I had nothing to be happy about in my life. And I'm going to go quickly through my childhood, into my teenage years, into my adulthood, and into where I'm at today, because I like to focus more on my recovery, because that's the most important part of my story is my recovery. And so if I lose you, if you have any questions, feel free to ask me. I'm more than willing to answer them after the meeting. But I grew up in a Christian alcoholic home. My dad was my first of many alcoholics in my life. I'm the youngest of three boys. My dad was actually beating and abusing my mom long before my brothers and I were ever born. My dad is a Marine, a former Marine, Semper Fi. And I have a lot of respect for my dad. And throughout my story, you're going to hear, how does he have respect for his dad? Because my dad's the one who has taught me every form of abuse that you could possibly go through as a child. I've been molested. I've been beat. I've been burned. I've gone through multiple things in my childhood that you would think, how can this man stand here today and say that he actually loved his dad? And it's because of this program that I could stand here and say I love my dad. And it's because of my sponsor who taught me how to be a better son so I could love my dad. One of the things I remember as a kid, my brothers and I were playing with matches. Actually, I was the one playing with the matches, and they were telling me not to do so. And my dad, who would come home drunk multiple nights, multiple days, doesn't matter, came home drunk at all hours, smelt the matches burning. And you know, he used to beat us pretty hard. He used to throw us around the rooms, spank us, beat us, all kinds of stuff. And he smelt the sulfur and said he was playing with matches. My brothers and I didn't want to turn me in because none of us wanted to get beat. But I realized that he was getting ready to start beating us, so I stood up and said, "Dad, it was me. My brothers did nothing with this." And I stood there waiting for the next beating that was going to happen, because I knew it was going to happen. Except this time he didn't beat me. He actually grabbed my arm and started dragging me into the kitchen. And as he's dragging me to the kitchen, I'm thinking, what the hell is going on here? And then he turns on the stove. And he starts to move my hand to the stove, so I rip my hand away from my dad, and he starts beating the hell out of me. And he says, "This time I'm going to put your hand there, and you're going to keep it there until I tell you to take it off." So my dad started burning my hand. Probably a few seconds, but enough to be scarring for life and to think about that. And you know, his whole mentality of this was, you know, you need to know what you're doing, because if you catch the house on fire, this is what it's going to feel like for all of us, kind of a thing. And today I realized my dad did the best he could. He didn't know any better. You know, my dad did with what he was taught. That's what Al-Anon has taught me. And when you listen to AA speakers, they'll tell you they were doing the best they knew how. And that's what I think my dad did. I think he was doing the best he knew how. I remember being in kindergarten. Of course, I get out of school before my brothers would, and my dad worked at night, so he would pick me up, and we'd head right over to Lil's Bar over on Limonite in Riverside, where I grew up at. And my dad would drink his lunch while I had a hamburger and a bottle of 7-Up. That was almost a daily routine. I remember one of the safest times I felt with my dad was when we were turning onto our street. And I'm not trying to be rude here. I'm just trying to watch how much time I have. I remember the car door flew open, and I started sliding across that way. And my dad's big arm just grabbed me and held me tight. And I felt loved and I felt secured from my dad. That was like what such an interesting dynamic in my life, I guess, is the best way to say it. Because there was those moments like that when my dad was extremely loving and extremely caring, and then there was those moments of abuse. My parents divorced when I was 10. We moved in with my grandparents, and I swear up and down, if I could be half the man that my grandfather is, my kids will be just fine in life. My grandfather taught me how to be a better man. I didn't realize it at the time growing up. I just thought, you know, he was just a hard person. He grew up in the 40s and all that stuff like that, and what he said was it. That was it, and that's the way it was. He never laid a hand on me, but unfortunately, one of our neighbors, who was also alcoholic, started molesting me and my brothers as well. He eventually committed suicide once it came out that he was molesting the kids. We'd visit my dad once in a while. He was still drinking. He was trying to get sober off and on. I remember he was in a treatment home for a while there, and all of us were there on family night. We said, you know, they went around the room asking, having everyone share. And I remember saying to my dad, if you love me, you'll quit drinking. And I didn't understand then, but today I understand that wasn't a matter of a choice for him. He couldn't stop at that one drink. He couldn't stop at his disease because he wasn't ready to stop at his disease yet. As time went on, I really started hating my dad a lot because he started missing his weekends with us. And the weekends he did pick us up, we went to his house and just worked all weekend, like, you know, doing the grass, pulling the weeds, doing all that stuff like that. And all we'd hear is our stepsisters share about, oh, well, you know, Dad took us to Disneyland last week, or, hey, Dad took us to Six Flags Magic Mountain, all that kind of stuff. And I remember despising my dad because of that. As time went on, got into high school, I always was a straight A, straight B student kind of a thing. My brothers got D's and C's and F's, and my family was okay with that. But when it came to my grades, I had to have straight A's. I was in trouble if I had B's or C's. It had to be a straight A because they expected more from me because they wanted me to go further. I was in marching band. I was in FFA, and had another person start molesting me, which was tough. It's a tough thing. You know, it's a very hard thing to go through. And I remember, like, growing up starting to hate God. The God that I grew up in the Christian home, the God of the Bible, was a vengeful God. You know, if he was letting all these horrible things happen to me, he didn't love me, he didn't care about me. So as time goes on, I meet a girl who I quote-unquote love, and, you know, her family was perfect. Her dad was a rager, her mom was an alcoholic, her brother was a meth addict and an alcoholic. Hey, I got a winner, you know? I got the best winner I could have, you know? And she has the anger of her dad and all the chaos in her household. And, you know, she was a couple years younger than me. We were both in high school. And we start arguing a lot. And I remember one night, because she started hitting me, it's like, dude, I'm like 175 pounds at that time. I wish I was there still, but I'm not. You know, it's like, dude, you know, you're like 100 pounds in soaking wet clothing. What are you doing trying to hit me? And so I got pissed because I didn't want to be hit by her anymore. So I just grabbed her arms and I threw her on the ground, and I'm sitting over top of her and just yelling at her like, you're going to quit this behavior, not going to touch me again. I guess my threshold was there as far as the abuse I was going to take in my life. And, you know, things, oh, you know, love you, all that kind of stuff, makeup, all that fun stuff that that takes place. And, yeah, you guys know what I'm talking about. So as time goes on, we start fighting a lot more. You know, we start breaking up, getting back together, break up, getting back together, all that codependency, crazy stuff that we all go through. And the last time I broke up with her, she tried to break my nose. She was left-handed, and she was a softball player, a lot of strength, and just whacked me right in the nose, and the blood just gushed. And I knew that this was not healthy to be here anymore, so... Why that third time? I don't know, but, you know, it was enough to say, it's done. We're not going to go out anymore. she did the whole thing, oh, I'm pregnant, all that stuff like that. And I said, well, then, you know, we better go tell your parents, and I'm not going to get back together with you. I don't want to have a kid with you. We need to start talking about our options. And it came out a couple weeks later, she lied. She was hoping that we would get back together and that I would do the right country boy thing and, you know, get married to her. And so down the road, I find another girlfriend who also has her issues. Her brother is in jail because of crystal meth. Her other brother is sent up to live in Washington because he had a sex issue with someone. And her dad's an alcoholic. And so we're dating for a while. You know, things are good. We're supposed to go out one night with her brother and his sister or his girlfriend or something like that. And she says, hey, you know, he's not answering the phone. I better go over and make sure they're not fighting. I was like, no, this isn't going to happen this way. Our night was this. This is what we're doing. And she goes, no, I'm going to go over. And I said, well, if you go over, we're done. I'm not doing this. I've done this right before. It's not going to happen. So she left. And so I went about our night. I went to dinner. I went to the rodeo. I went and did the things that we had planned on doing. I went by myself. And surprisingly, I had a really good time doing it. So when I got home, I got all of her stuff back together, all in the boxes, you know, and she comes over, hey, what's going on? I need my house key. Well, what are you talking about? We're done. She goes, no, we can't be finished. I said, this is what I told you earlier. We're finished. And she goes, she got really angry. She starts yelling at me, and she yells at me, I could kill you right now and not even think about it. Yeah, I think this is why we don't belong together, you know. So at that point, I swore off women. You know what? Screw it. I don't need a woman. I need to focus on Matt. I need to take care of myself. I need to figure out, why do I keep doing these stupid things I'm doing? This is my thinking problem I have that most of us have. Because, you know, one side says, oh, do this. The other says, no, do this. And pretty quick, the whole committee is going and everyone has their own opinion. And it's true, right? I mean, you guys know what I'm saying. So after, you know, maybe a month or two of swearing off women, I hey, it's honesty, right? It's a program of honesty. So I end up meeting my wife. God, you know, she was perfect. She was an awesome woman. You know, she had her own place. She didn't appear to need me. You know, we went on our first date. It was a great night. We had a fun time. You know, the whole next week we spent every day together. She'd come to Riverside. I'd go to Woodland Hills. We just, you know, spent the whole time together that we could. And it was a lot of fun. About a month later, I moved in. 3 months later, I proposed to her. 9 months later, we were married. Very nice. And it was too fast, way too fast. And I knew better. But hey, you know what? I got someone who loves me. I got someone who cares about me. You know, and both of her parents, by God's grace, have multiple years, like 30 some odd years in AA together. And, you know, she grew up in the rooms of AA. So, you know, she was a good person. That's what I saw on the outside. I could bring home a bottle of wine, and that bottle of wine would be gone. I would have maybe half a glass. It would be gone within an hour. And so I just decided I wouldn't bring home wine anymore, right? That's one of the controlling behaviors we have. She by all means, is not an alcoholic. From my understanding, alcoholism is a self-diagnosed disease, and she has never once said she's an alcoholic. I think she drinks more than what she should, because the tendencies appear to be there. The finances all started going chaotic. You know, I was out of work for a while. She wasn't working. When I got back to work, money kept going to the house. I kept going into our stuff. And for whatever reason, I started getting calls from bill collectors at work, which bugged the hell out of me. And so I had worked for her dad. I was going to be taking over his family business, his automotive shop he had in the valley. And so I was working for him, and I just went to him and said, hey, here's what's going on. I don't know if you can do this or not. If you don't want to, I understand. But I need about $3,000 to make these calls stop. I will gladly pay you back, take it out of my check, do whatever you want to, but I will pay you back every dime of this and interest or whatever I need to do. And he said, that's not a problem. I just wrote a check and said, here you go. Don't worry about it. One of the things I did later on, I paid him back because that was an important thing to do, is to pay him back. He bailed us out. I went home that night, wrote out every single check, had her sign them all, put them in envelopes, sent them out the next day, and that was it. And then we had like a peeping Tom issue, so we sold our condo, moved to Simi Valley. We had an issue where I wanted kids, she didn't want kids, so I finally got to the point where I don't need to have kids, it's okay. And probably about our third wedding anniversary rolled around, and she goes, how do you feel about having kids? I don't want them. You know, you don't want them. I don't have to have them. I got my nephews and nieces. I'm good. She says, well, let's go and have a baby. Okay, great. Let's go. I'm not going to argue that one. And I think at that point, our marriage was already in trouble. And like both of us knew it, but we didn't want to admit that we were in trouble. So maybe having a kid was going to fix it. And, God bless us with twin girls. Unfortunately, it was on the first try. It didn't go as long as I would like it to go. But, you know, hey, it's the truth. Every guy in here is thinking the same thing. You know what? Sometimes we hope we have to try a little bit harder. But we had these beautiful twins. And I'm grateful every day for my twin daughters. They are everything to me. They're a strong part of my recovery. They're a strong part of my life. They're a reason why I'm alive. As a kid, I thought about suicide. As a teenager, I thought about suicide. I remember being 10 or 11 years old. I had the knife actually at my neck, thinking, can I cut the jugular vein hard enough that I'll bleed out and die? Well, that might be too painful, so maybe I should slit my wrist. Well, maybe I should just try to fall it onto my heart. And you know what? For whatever reason, God put in my head one of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill. So I didn't want to go to hell because I was already living it, so I don't want to be there. So fine, I won't kill myself, God. And so back to marriage life again, sorry. I jump around a lot sporadically. I apologize for it. Back to married life. I hate my dad, not talking to him, things like that. He lives in Illinois. I want nothing to do with him. I talk to my mom on a regular basis. She lives up north. These kids, we've been blessed with these kids. And I had no idea how, when you're the doctor say twins, the first thing a guy thinks is, how the hell am I going to pay for this? Because that's the only thing that was in my head, is how am I going to pay for this? I had enough money for one kid, two kids, maybe not. And I remember having those kids with her, and we stayed with my in-laws for the longest time. Ended up buying a house about a year and a half later. We bought a nice little place out in Santa Clarita. It started going to this thing. I remember this specifically, Father's Day 06. I was expected to go do something with her and the kids that day, and she said, no, I don't love you anymore, but buy me a house and we'll work on this. And y'all, we bought a house. You already heard me say it. I bought a house. And pretty much whatever Christine wanted, it's suddenly becoming whatever she wanted, I ran out and bought. I stopped myself at the car that she wanted because, you know, it was cheaper to rent one for the weekend and make sure I'd be happy with it before we bought that car. And by our wedding anniversary, her birthday and our wedding anniversary is almost the same time frame, our marriage was crap. There was nothing left. There was nothing there. We did one last ditch effort on a trip to San Francisco to see if we could save it. Get back, and it was not a good trip. The month after that was not a good trip. And at this point, you know, the kids are about a year and a half old. And I remember that she would, like, disappear. She was going back to college, wanted to go dance, things like that. I was supportive of it. You know, did whatever you want, go enjoy it. And I remember, like, going to, like, plays with her and stuff like that. Her friends were in. And afterwards, you know, there was a bunch of people that wanted to go to dinner. So, yeah, let's all go to dinner. So we all went to dinner. I ended up buying everyone dinner that night. It wasn't a big deal. The guy she left me for was sitting across the table from me. So it tells me that they were probably together, and he was probably caught off guard. Her husband was with her. But anyways, I remember September pretty clear. On our wedding anniversary, September 15th, we got in a huge argument. I was driving home. She was not coming home. She made it clear her and the kids were going to go out with her friends. Or actually, the kids were going to stay at the babysitter while she went out with her friends to go do whatever they wanted to go do. And I went off the handle. I got so angry. I started yelling at her on the cell phone, freaking out. And I said, you know what? I'm just going to my life. And I hung up. And I remember being on the 14 freeway on the truck bypass lane. There was a semi behind me and one up on my left, thinking, if I slam my brakes hard enough and crank it hard enough, will these guys kill me? And then the next thought that came in my head, if they rule this suicide, your kids don't get that $1 million life insurance policy you have. That's another shot of God. That's God saying, dude, you can't do this. Your kids need a stable parent. The next 2 weeks, everything spiraled out of control. I destroyed our house. I kicked in walls. I broke her laptop. We were supposed to go do things as a family for our anniversary. It became from us doing a thing as a family to you're going to stay home and watch the kids while I go out with my friends for our anniversary. I don't know how that happened, but it did. And I was pissed. I was beyond pissed. So my mother-in-law would not let her move back into her house, but she let me move back into her house because I needed a place to stay. We decided we couldn't live together. We needed to be separated. And I remember my mother-in-law, around that Father's Day incident, had suggested to me I try Al-Anon because she had been going to Al-Anon for almost a year before that. And there was a pamphlet that she left. There was one spot I always put my keys, my phone, wallet, everything at her house. And there was a spot where this pamphlet was at the whole time. I remember walking by it, you know, oh yeah, it's just collecting dust, things like that. And for whatever reason, my world was so small that night, I grabbed that pamphlet and I started reading. I was like, what a bunch of dummies reading the stories. And then there was the man's, seriously, I was like, what a bunch of dummies. You know, this is ego, guys. Ego sitting here screaming, these guys are a bunch of wimps. Look at all these women crying about their men and crying about that. And then the man's story came up, and it was my story. I almost was in tears, bawling my eyes out. And when Connie got home from her meeting, I asked her, I said, can you tell me where a meeting is for tomorrow night? And she said, yeah. She pulled out her meeting directory. There was a men's Reseda Stag meeting on Wednesday night. She told me where the meeting hall was, how to get there. You know, if I wanted to go, just go. There's no, like, special invitation. You don't have to have, like, a secret handshake or something to go to this meeting. So I go home from work, get changed, you know, say, hey, I'm off to the meeting. She goes, okay, great, have a good time. And that was it. That was the extent of the conversation. And she said, you know, do you need directions? No, I'm good. I have an idea where it's at. So I took off and I called my brother. And, of course, he's the voice of reason. You know, you don't need that meeting. They need the meetings. They're the idiots. They're the ones that are doing all this stuff to you, da-da-da. I said, you know what? I told Connie I would go. I need to go. I need to make that commitment. I got there probably about 10, 15 minutes late, sat right next to the door so that way I could leave like 10 minutes early kind of a thing. And, you know, I'm looking around this room, reading the slogans that are around there, not having an idea what any of that stuff means, reading the 12 steps, going like, what's this stuff about? And just listening to these guys share. And my good buddy Chris shared about having twin boys that were almost 2 years old and or a year and a half old or something like that. And that nailed me. You have twins? I got to ask this guy, how is he doing this? And so I talked to him. I said, hey, you have twins? He goes, yeah, I have twins. I said, so do I. Mine are a year and a half old also. And you know what? We became friends. We started going out together, taking the kids places like to parks and, you know, riding trains and stuff like that. I think if he didn't share that night, I probably would not have stayed in Al-Anon. That was a God shot. I think God had him say that at that moment so I would hear it, so I'd be open for it. And when the last person to share, of course, is the newcomer, they say, do the newcomers have anything to say? And everyone turns back to you, and my mouth opened and nothing but diarrhea came out. Like, I just dumped on these guys like there was no tomorrow. And, you know, it probably saved my life. It really did. And then they said, well, keep coming back. By the way, you know, we recommend 90 meetings in 90 days. Fine. Okay, I could do that. And, you know, they came up and circled, here, you're going to go here, you're going to go here, all that kind of stuff. You know the way that we mob newcomers and you circle all the meetings and call me here, call this number. So I went to probably 100 some odd meetings in my first 90 days of Al-Anon. The third meeting I went to, I met my sponsor. He's my sponsor today, but when I first met him, I thought he was a wacko because he was laughing and smiling and I'm in all this pain. How could you be doing this? It didn't make sense to me. Like, you know, how can you be laughing when I'm dying here? You have no idea what I'm going through. And, they say don't discount the messenger. Don't discount the message because of the messenger. That's one of the things my sponsor tells me. And, of course, I discounted his message because he was happy. I wasn't happy. I was wallowing in self-pity. Like you know, you go, Matt, you're a poor guy. I can't believe she's doing that. So, I get a temporary sponsor, get things going, and I start my own little detective agency. You know, I start hacking her MySpace page and emails, and, you know, I'm catching her cheating on me and all that stuff like that. My first sponsor says to me things like, well, what does it matter if she's banging half of America? It's none of your business. Well, she's my wife. It doesn't matter. You need to focus on that. And it finally came down to things like, did you eat today? Did you eat yet? Okay, you haven't eaten yet? Good. Go down there to Subway, get a sandwich or McDonald's or whatever. Go get this, eat, and call me back and tell me what you had. He would say things to me like, where are your feet at? Well, they're at work. Then get your head there too. Things like that. Like, you know, this ain't rocket scientist, guys, but let's face it. It is rocket scientist when you're a newcomer and you're in this turmoil and you're all this crap and your life is ending because you don't know what's going on. Around the same time, my dad starts contacting me. Hey, Matt, how's it going? Leave me alone, Dad, I hate you. Kind of a thing. You know, and that kind of stuff is going on in my life. You know, I'm emailing people. You know, my world is like very, very small. All I have is my family. Everyone in my family hates my wife because she's leaving me and the kids. My mother-in-law won't really talk to her daughter because she's pretty pissed about it too, but she's trying to keep it clean, keep it on her side of the street. I'm with my kids on a continuous basis. I'd work 16 hours a day. I lost my job at the shop because her father didn't want her getting the shop in the divorce. So I'm towing, driving tow trucks, taking care of my kids, like all this chaos. I'd come home from work, get the kids in bed, and my mother-in-law would say, great, go have a good meeting. And that's my life. It's just nonstop cycle, nonstop meetings, nonstop work, keeping myself busy every weekend, spending time with my kids. And Catalina was another trip that saved my life. If you ever get a chance and someone says, hey, go to this retreat, whether it's a men's workshop, women's workshop, Catalina or four-step workshops, things like that, go to them. If they say go to this, go to it. There's a reason why they're telling you to go to it. You need it. And you know, my first one was the men's 11-step workshop up in Fraser Park, where I met Ed Kay. Ed is one of the nicest guys I've ever met. He was looking at me and said, hey, Matt, do you like to laugh? Oh, yeah, I like to laugh. Good, you're going to go to Catalina and you're going to be on a skit. Okay, and you're going to be on the committee. Okay, and that was it. You're going to do this. I realized at this point in my recovery that my life is getting better. Like, I'm feeling better about myself, although I still have issues, but I feel better. So I start, I go to Catalina, this Catalina trip that everyone talks about, and it was an amazing weekend. Like, my whole life changed. I came home that weekend, and my ex-wife was dropping the kids off at the house, and I said to her, we're going to do one of two things. Either you're going to stop your behavior, and we're going to move back in together, we're going to go get marriage counseling, and we're going to put this whole thing behind us, or either that, we're getting a divorce. And she goes, well, funny you should mention that, because I've been seeing someone. No shit. Sorry. No duh. As if I didn't know. And I said, great. Then let's proceed with our divorce. And, you know, we started our divorce proceedings, and that worked out great. Down the road, her and her boyfriend decided they wanted to move into, I got this great idea. I can go move in with the girl I started dating, which is not a good idea, especially if you're dating an Al-Anon, because this is where my story really gets crazy. This is where it gets really crazy. We end up breaking up very, very quickly, which is not a surprise. And of course, you know, she suggests that, you know, we live apart, but we'll still date and try to work on our relationship. And at this time, I'm talking to my new sponsor, and he says to me, you know, the best thing for you to do is move, things like that. And so I get into the apartment, and she's having behaviors that I don't agree with, taking off to trips to other places and just randomly like ride sharing off of Craigslist, like you could ride share with people or something like that, and people she's never met. And it's like, okay, this is bizarre. But anyway, she calls me up and says, hey, can you come help me hang the curtains? Yeah, I'll come help you hang curtains. Of course, we're not together anymore. And, you know, so I'm there helping her hang curtains, and she gets a phone call, and she starts talking to a new guy who's waiting to come over because they need privacy when they're in the bedroom. So I got pissed off and I left. And, you know, she's all, where are you going? You're not done yet. I'm done. Like, lose my number. Leave me alone. You know, and I start going through a series of, the best way. I start trying to fill a void in my life, which I know was I didn't love myself enough. But, you know, I was buying cars for women. I was paying tickets. I was paying mortgages. I was willing to pay it as long as you had sex with me. I'd be willing to pay whatever you wanted. And, you know, not a very proud moment in my life. It was rough. It got very, very bad financially for me because as I'm getting evicted, you have a car and I don't, kind of a thing. My sponsor told me I had to share that tonight, so that's why I'm sharing that. but I had already planned on sharing that. I finally met the right one for me, and it was funny because in all my pain, all my chaos, I was calling my sponsor every day, going to meetings, doing this, doing that, and I didn't call my sponsor for about 2 weeks, and I get this phone call in the morning on my way to work. Hey, Matt, how you doing? Doing good. How are you doing? Yeah. So what's your name? What? What's her name? What do you mean, what's her name? Well, I started thinking about all the things I did, and this was her name. And So, you know, I had to tell him the new girl's name and stuff like that. And he goes, great, bring her to a Friday night meeting. Okay. So we started going to meetings together. You know, we lasted for almost a couple years, and it looked like it was going to work out great for us, and we were going to get married and stuff. And she broke up with me before she decided to cheat. She said, if I decide to cheat at some point, I'm going to break up with you before I do it. And she did that. I asked for the car back and was told no. Someone had suggested to me, I think it might have been the minister at church, said, well, find out exactly when she stopped loving you, because if she stopped loving you before you gave her the car, then that gift was no longer out of love. She accepted it no longer out of love. Okay, cool. So down the road, she decided to give it back to me, which was nice because someone else gave her a car. And this is all in program, guys. This is all while I'm in program. This is how distorted I was. So, you know, I stopped relationships for the most part for a while there. Started working on myself some more. My sponsor suggested to me I finish the 12 steps. I was just about done with them, so I finished that. Then he suggested I start working on traditions for marriage and relationships, because as long as I was going to keep doing these crazy things, no one was going to be with me long enough to see where it played out. I ended up with this amazing woman. I'm getting married in October to this phenomenal woman. This program will change your life, because it's changed mine drastically. My ex-wife, who I hated for a long time there, I would never talk bad about her in front of the kids, and I would never talk anything about her that I did not want the kids to hear. I would not say to anyone, unless it was my sponsor, my brother's group. When she decided to move in with her boyfriend, I asked for his last name. She said, no, I'm not going to give that to you. And I talked to my sponsor about it, and he said, you know, if your motives... depends on your motives. And I said, well, my motives are to make sure he's not a pedophile, because I don't want my kids to go through what I went through. And I know a lot of pedophiles will prey on single parents. And they said, then you're just in that. And so I gave her a certain date and told her, if you don't give it to me by this date, I'm going to get a restraining order against you, and I'm going to protect my kids until you give me that name so I can do a background check. And I told her, I understand, you know, if he was 18, 19, 20 years old and still having sex with his high school sweetheart, or if he had a pot conviction. But what I would not understand if he was like 23 having sex with a 14, 15, 16 year old, because you have no business being with someone at that age. She refused to, and instead I got the restraining order slapped on me at work. And I was pretty angry about it. And fortunately that night we had a brothers meeting. So I went to the brothers meeting, and I was angry and just so furious, and I went off on them. And afterwards, all of them came up to me and gave me some words of encouragement. Now, what's interesting, I was supposed to be going to Hawaii with the ex-girlfriend that I was hanging curtains for, because we had already bought our tickets for Hawaii. And, you know, I didn't want to go on that trip. I was pissed about it. And my sponsor was saying, you know, the only thing you're losing is just the airfare. If you can cancel hotels and everything else, you're just losing the airfare right now, which is only a few $100. So take your loss before you go there and pay for everything again. It just so happens that our court date was a day before Hawaii, and because I was so nervous about that court date, I said, I'm not going to Hawaii. And she says to me, well, what about me? This is about my kids. F you. I don't need you in my life. My kids need me. And I remember getting a lawyer right away. I talked to her dad. Her dad said, call my lawyer. I'm pretty upset with what she's doing. So call my lawyer, talk to him, and he'll give you the same rate he gave me, kind of a thing. So I had this awesome lawyer. He called her right away. He called me back maybe an hour later and said, Matt, you'll have your kids next weekend. The kids will be seeing you on a regular basis now. Just don't contact her until you meet with the mediator. And I remember talking to my sponsor before I was going into court, and he said to me, you know, he had worked with the court systems before, and he said to me, you know, Matt, when you get there, either the bailiff or the court reporter or the judge or the mediator, someone there is going to be an AA or Al-Anon. They're going to know a 12-step program. Someone will be there, and they're going to be an advocate for you, because once it comes out that that's what you're doing, they're going to be happy to hear that. And so sure enough, the mediator starts beating me up like I'm the meanest person in the world when I'm sitting there. And I said, you know, this is what I want. This is why I want it. And I said, you know, my sponsor has told me that I'm justified in this action because it's to protect my children. She goes, sponsor for what? I said, for Al-Anon. Oh, my first Al-Anon meeting was February 1977. Awesome. Awesome. That whole thing of me slipping out my sponsor, this flipped that whole conversation around, where she was now against my wife. She was so angry that my wife would not even give her the name so she could give it to the judge to have a background check to make sure my kids were safe. And she told me in her report she's going to put down that the judge needs to demand the name, and if not, she doesn't get visitation rights. A few weeks later, she finally gave me the name, which pissed me off because I paid a lot of money in lawyer fees that we didn't have to spend that way. It could have been spent on the kids. But that's life. So my ex-wife and I have made full circle. She almost died in December. December 29th, I got a phone call, bring the kids quick. Their mom's going to die this weekend. And the first call I made to was her boyfriend out of his work and said, hey, Phil, you need to get there quick. She's dying. She's not going to make it. Long story, too far to go into right now, but I'll talk to you outside. I called her dad, told her dad. I called her aunts and uncles. I started calling her friends. I left a message for my sponsor. He was back east. I knew he'd call me back once he had a chance to. And I called my fiance because we were supposed to go down to San Diego to pick up kids from a friend that they were staying with for the week while their mom was in the hospital. And that was the quickest I've ever gone down to San Diego and back, even though it was on a holiday weekend, traffic everywhere. We didn't tell the kids what was going on, but somewhere in Mission Viejo, we got off when my sponsor called me, and she went through the drive-thru while I was talking to my sponsor, and I was concerned because I didn't know whether my kids should see their mom in that state or should they not. And he said, you know, Matt, he goes, sure, you can make the right decision today. You could say, no, the kids won't see mom. But in 10 years, when your kids come up to you and say, Dad, why didn't you let us see mom? And I could tell them why, and they would say, well, that wasn't really your choice to make. And he was right. That would not have been my choice to make. My kids are 7 years old at the time. They can make that decision themselves. So we went to the hospital, saw mom. One of my girls said it best, mom doesn't look like she's getting better. I don't think she's going to live. I want to leave this room. And so we left the room. That whole weekend we spent praying. I spent a lot of that weekend on the phone, just phone calls left and right from her family, from her boyfriend, from her dad, from the hospital. And my sponsor suggested I be of service to her family, to myself, and to my kids. My fiance was phenomenal. He said, you know, Matt, this will either make or break your relationship. And love is an action word. I never understood. Every time my sponsor said, Matt, love's an action word, with all these previous women, I never understood what he meant until I met the woman I'm with today. Love is an action word. Love is what you actually do. It's not what you say, it's what you do. It's your actions that'll define it. When she showed up to my house every night to watch on Tuesday nights to watch my kids, she would race home from work to watch my kids for me at my house so I can go to class. When she came on Friday nights to watch my kids, because they didn't really want to go to the meetings anymore, to watch my kids for me so I go to my Friday night meeting. When she would watch my kids on Saturday so I could go to work. When she did all these things for me, it showed her love. She would help me with my homework. She would do things to make my life easier. My ex-wife got that phone call. It was her voice on the line. I was never so happy to hear her voice ever. So happy. It was 6 weeks in a coma, medically induced, and she was getting better as time was going on. And I remember recording things from the kids and taking it and playing it for her while she was still sleeping. Kids were drawing pictures, things like that, and I wouldn't let them see her because of the respirator. When they decided to do a trach, I took the kids in to see their mom, and it helped the kids. It boosted their spirits to know mom was getting better. It's not as bad as they thought it was. And, it was very interesting to be of service to her. And the first night there, I had asked her boyfriend, did you eat? I'll go get you some food if you need me to. No, I ate. I'm fine. Got some stuff from his house that the kids would need, and I stayed in contact with him. I was trying to be of service to him too. You know, they need to see the love of this program. My dad, I want to touch base on my dad, the man that I hated for so many years, that I am proud today to call my dad and that I love. My dad made an amends to me almost a few years ago through an email to my brothers and to me saying he'd change his life around. He had 10 years sobriety, not because of AA, but because the doctor said your next drink will kill you. So my dad was too scared to drink. He just wouldn't do it. He had done so much damage to his liver, there was no repairing it. For the longest time, I remember his first heart attack that I know was when I was 16. So he had a defibrillator in his heart because he had a weird heartbeat. And it was one they always kept changing out to something else. And I remember I got a call saying, hey, this is when I was dating my fiance when we were still in the early stages of our relationship. I got a call saying, it's not good. Dad's not going to make it past a year. That's what the doctors are saying. So I became a better son. After my dad made his amends to me, I talked to my sponsor about it. He said, take it for what it is. I was worried my dad was doing like this, so I need money, I need this kind of a thing. And he said, you know, Matt, you could always hang up the phone if the conversation goes the way you don't want it to go. You could always stop the email. You don't have to reply right now. You could always stop the behavior. And so I had a relationship with my dad for about the last year and a half of his life. I remember him telling me, Matt, you know, it's not as bad as they thought. Things are fine kind of a thing. And I could, you know, it was funny because when my dad was dying, I was in a sense of urgency of, okay, I got to get back to Illinois. I got to see my dad before he dies. Got to go hug him. Got to go tell him I love him one more time and just tell him that I can forgive you for everything, Dad. And I'm glad that you've become the dad you are today to me. I got to be a better son. When he's called up and said, oh, no, the doctors are wrong. I'm fine. That sense of urgency left. Unfortunately, on May 23rd, he passed away a couple years ago. He went into the hospital for the last time, had a cigarette, his last cigarette when he walked in the hospital. And my dad was 55 years old, maybe 57, I'm sorry. Anyways, it doesn't matter. Basically what happened is he had very bad pneumonia, emphysema, all that stuff like that. And he actually passed away. And I wouldn't doubt if my dad took off his monitors and stuff. He was notorious for taking stuff off when you're not supposed to. They said the only reason why they knew my dad had died was because about 8 minutes later his defibrillator hit, and it hit hard. And if you've ever seen someone get defibrillated, it zaps you pretty hard. And that's when they realized that my dad had redlined and or flatlined, whatever they call it. And they got air back into his body, things like that. I spent the whole next week talking to my brothers, to my stepfamily, to my stepmom. And I said to her, I said, you know what? You got to pull the plug. My dad would not want to live as a vegetable. He's brain dead. He's not coming back. My brothers and I all agree on this. We'll support your decision. Keep him there as long as you want, but we'd rather pull the plug now. And she finally agreed to pull the plug. My sponsor told me before I went back to the funeral to be of service. I got to the funeral. They had asked my oldest brother to read the eulogy. He said no, he wouldn't do it. My next brother said he wouldn't do it, so they asked me. And the only words that came out of my mouth was, I'm here to be of service. So whatever you need. And they said, we need you to do this. I went right, read my dad's eulogy. We had him cremated, and he was buried in his Marine Corps suit, and he had something in his hand. He had the Marine Corps cross, and I asked my stepmom if I could have that. That was the one thing I wanted from my dad, was to just have that one piece, one article, and she gave it to me. And they also gave ones to my brothers as well. And that was an interesting trip, because every time I'm in pain, my program jump starts a lot more, and I think that's how it works for most of us. I did traditions probably 4, 5, 6, 7, something like that, on the plane rides back and forth. My older brother, who is the one who says, you still go to those meetings? You don't need that stuff. You know what? You're probably right. I don't need it, but I'm going to keep going because I'm a better person. I like who I am because of those meetings. I had the chance to, on the plane ride back, we were sitting right next to each other. We finally had seats together. And he said to me, so what are you doing anyways? Well, this is what my program is, and I put away my stuff, and I had time to 12th step my brother. Whether he finds these rooms or not is not my business. That's for him and his higher power. Where I'm at today, my life is great. I love where I'm at. I have trials and tribulations just like anyone else. Finances aren't always the greatest. You know, my relationship with my ex-wife isn't always the greatest, but there's one thing that we both agree on. Our kids are more important. So when our kids have a school event, she sits in that chair, her boyfriend's there, I'm there, and my fiance's there. We all sit together. We all save seats for each other. We'll buy tickets for stuff together just to make sure we all hold seats, because our kids are more important than our egos. There's things I hear people talk about, well, he does this and she does that. I remember as a kid, my mom never talked bad about my dad. I knew about my dad. I knew he was an alcoholic. I knew the problems he had. She never once said those things to me because she didn't want me to feel 50% bad, because 50% of my genetic makeup comes from my dad. So if my dad's an a-hole, my dad's a jerk, my dad's this, my dad's that, that's who I am. My mom never once did that stuff, and I appreciate that she never did that, because I don't do that about my ex-wife. I want my kids growing up knowing that their mom is a wonderful woman, and what she does is what she does. I'm not going to engage into it. Sometimes my kids will say things to me, Dad, you know, tell us about the fight that you and mom had when we were this age. I'm not going to talk to you about that. That's none of your business. And how would you know about that? Well, mom told us. Okay. And that was a quick, hey, don't tell the kids things that happened between us. They don't need that stuff. What they need to know is mom and dad couldn't get along. That's all they need to know. and that we get along now because we love them, and that's all that matters. If you're divorced in this program, going through a divorce, if you have a split family, do nothing but love your kids. Never talk bad about that person. That's something I learned from my sponsor. That's something I learned from these rooms. That's something I learned from my mom. My sponsor, Chris, has been the best thing for me in my life. My brother's group is an amazing brother's group. I was a complete nutcase when I came in this program, and today I'm a changed person. I have had some sponsees. I have had to let go of all my sponsees when I went back to school. I did not find it to be fair to them that I could not be there when they needed me. So I helped them find someone else, encouraged them to go find other people. My sponsees that I did have, I'm good friends with them. I love them. I get time with them. I have all these amazing brothers and sisters in this program. The first phone call I ever made was the hardest phone call I ever made, and it was all this stuff came out, and my life changed because I started purging so much stuff. You know, I love this program very much. My kids love this program. I remember one time I was angry with my ex-wife, and her dad was saying something, and my kids saw I was angry, and they started saying the Serenity Prayer. My kids, at 3.5, 4 years old, reminded me that I need to stop and say the Serenity Prayer. My sponsor, you know that slogan, let go or let God, or let go and let God. My sponsor gave me the slogan. He said, we're going to change that for you because you have this problem where you like want to be wrestling that freight train. You want to be holding onto that rope that is that freight train's getting ready to take out of the station. You need to let go or be dragged. There's a couple other things. The pain and suffering does not lie in the surrender. It lies in the resistance. And when I'm in pain, same thing. Let go or be dragged. You got to let go of it or be dragged all the way through this. Let's see here. Newcomers, I strongly suggest that you call someone. Get a phone number tonight. Get a phone number and talk to someone because it'll save your life. It'll make a huge difference. A couple more things I want to close up here before I end. I was once told this, the will of God won't take you where the grace of God can't follow. And I've gone through a lot of crap. I went from being burned. I went from being molested. I went from being this unloving or unworthy person of love into this great man and before you guys today. God has changed my life through this program. I had to raise up an inner child inside myself, and I get to call my sponsor and tell him Happy Father's Day. He gets to be a role model for me. My brother Bob, my brother's group is an amazing group of men that I get to look forward to and I get to share my stories with. I love it whenever one of my brothers calls me like Evan. I love hearing what he has going on in his life with his kids or with his ex-wife or with this or with that. And I get to share my experience, strength, and hope. And if I don't have it, I don't say anything. Because I learned early on, I think means nothing in this program. What I know is what you want to know. My sponsor taught me that, and he is damn right on that one. It's what I know is what matters, because that is what's going to help you. So if I don't have experience in it, I'm going to tell you I don't have experience in it. But these people, I've heard them share, call them, because they probably have that experience, because I've heard them touch on it. And then the last thing I want to touch on, one of my good buddy Chris in this program, he... we have an interesting story. We were sharing one time at the Ventura County AA convention and spiritual meeting. And he stands up and says his name and says, I was married September 15th, 2001, and my jaw dropped. I was married September 15th, 2001. He has twin boys. I have twin girls. Both of them are fraternal, both almost the same age. So it's like there's so many things in this program that start lining up when you're supposed to be here. And just because you didn't hear your story tonight doesn't mean no one has had it. Because everyone in this room has had a different experience, and everyone has a different story. We're all here because we all love alcoholics. The last thing is the thing that he gave me when I got to Catalina one year. Because I go every year, but not every year do I go on the day the committee goes. Sometimes I go a day late. And he gave me a slip of paper, and it said, thank you, God, for all the things I feared which have not happened. Fear, it'll kill you. But the faith and knowing that God will take care of you will change your life. Thank you all. My name is Matthew Myers. Thanks for letting me play.